As federal courts continue to uphold gay marriage, more and more same-sex couples are exchanging rings and signing marriage licenses. These days, it's almost hard to remember, but there was originally a progressive wing of the gay liberation movement that was not at first in favor of gay marriage. Among them, Edmund White. He's a novelist and cultural critic who's witnessed and written about 5 decades of gay liberation. He was there at the Stonewall riots. He watched his closest friends die of AIDS, and today he lives with his husband, writer Michael Carroll, but he still has somewhat mixed feelings about gay marriage.
For a long time, I guess I was opposed to what I called gay assimilation. I thought that gays should live in a very exemplary but utterly different way from straight people, and that we were sort of the vanguard pointing the way to new kinds of association.
It was kind of an opportunity, rather than mimic a heterosexual, quote-unquote, normal lifestyle. It was an opportunity to create an entirely new and different lifestyle.
Most of us who were openly gay in the 70s were fairly radical in politics. I mean, that we had been active in other movements like Black Liberation, Women's Liberation, anti-war movement. So we had a kind of radical mentality, which meant that we didn't want to just imitate this most traditional of all institutions, marriage.
So this was the 70s.
And
a real kind of golden age. So just to contrast, when you were in the 60s, you were working at Time Life Books, and, you know, this was kind of the Mad Men era. How would you get from Time Life Books down to the Village and to the bar scene? Was it like putting on a whole different identity for yourself?
Yeah, it was like Superman. I mean that you wore a coat and tie during the day, and to your office mates, friends, you would talk about, you'd make up, if let's say you're going out with a 6'3" blonde boy, you'd say, talk about going out with a 5'6" blonde girl and invent her name. And it made you very good at lying, because not only did you have to invent plausible stories, but you also had to remember them. So you'd write down notes about all your lies and fictions that you'd created.
You'd actually write them down?
Yeah. So you'd remember them. I mean, if you wanted to have a personal life and talk about it to your straight friends who were confiding in you, you had to tell them something, but you couldn't tell them the truth because you would get fired. So you made up all this stuff.
Sounds like great training for a novelist.
Perfect training for a novelist.
The wonderful thing about talking with you is that you have lived through and written through the evolution of gay life over more than 5 decades of what has been one of the, you know, most momentous social changes in history. So by the time you came back to New York, then it's the 70s and everything has changed. Was it possible to be much more out at that point?
I used to think of the gay community as being very small, but suddenly it seemed like everybody was gay. I mean, there were hundreds of them. And I guess just a whole new atmosphere had come along.
You write about that period of time. The men you knew and were friends with and slept with were... they were writers and artists. It just sounds like it was this incredibly sophisticated, beautiful crowd.
The admission ticket to being gay in those days was being cultured. And you had to have read lots of things, or at least pretended to. And you had to go to the opera. You had to have opinions about this and that. And you had to have traveled in Europe and so on. I mean, there was a kind of pressure to be a very civilized being.
And that's different now?
Oh, yeah. Now all you have to do is go to the gym and be cute.
Of course, you were also, even then, I mean, we were talking about the promiscuous lifestyle. Being cute was pretty important then, too.
Well, I think that gay life at that time, especially, a gay man had to be as beautiful as a woman and as successful as a man. Because like on Fire Island, you'd see these beautiful boys with big muscles wandering around. And then you'd find out they were a brain surgeon or a lawyer or a CEO of a company. But these were very accomplished pretty boys. And that kind of double burden, I think, was very difficult for many people to sustain, because it was as though you were running in a race that nobody ever won. Because you were getting older every year, you maybe weren't as rich as the next person, and you had to be both successful and beautiful.
And then along comes AIDS. And so many of those men were the first to go.
That's right. Partly because they were radical in their politics and experimental in their sexuality. And they died, and they were oftentimes replaced by much squarer middle-class people, much more conservative people.
You're being polite. In print, you called them the dull normals.
Oh, well, you have too good a memory.
I was going to ask you, who are these poor guys you're calling dull normals?
Well, recently I wrote an article about gay marriage for the New York Review of Books, and it was mainly a reporting job, I mean, to talk about the whole battle against Proposition 8 in California. And I said that the two heterosexual lawyers who had represented the gay side of things in the court case on Proposition 8, they concluded their book by saying, and now we can see that gay people are just like everyone else, that they, too, are good members of the community and go to the PTA and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm not sure that's the gay world I've been fighting for.
Sounds like you're saying there was a politics to the choice of a promiscuous sexual lifestyle.
And a romance. I think that everybody assumes that anonymous sex must be very cold-blooded, and yet some of the most ecstatic nights I've ever spent in my life were with somebody whose name I didn't know, but who, after all, only takes a short while to have sex, and then you talk to the person all night long. And there are these kind of intense moments of communion that oftentimes follow what's, you know, pick up sex.
Well, so you maintained that lifestyle through and beyond the decade of AIDS. I mean, there were a lot of medical experts and probably friends of yours who said, oh, we should just all become celibate for until they figure this disease out.
Yes. The very first meeting where I ever heard a doctor talk about AIDS was in 1981. In the apartment of Larry Kramer, who eventually became the big leader of ACT UP. And this doctor, Friedman Keene, he said, well, we don't know what causes it or how to stop it. My suggestion is you should all be celibate. Well, to say that to a room full of case-hardened gays who were in their 20s and 30s just seemed utterly preposterous.
I guess what I don't understand, especially during that period of time, sex was killing people. Mm-hmm. If you knew it was a choice between sex or death, wouldn't you choose to give up sex?
It turns out no. you know, that it was too much of a part of our lives, and it was what we really... I mean, for my generation, in the 50s and 60s, we hadn't had very much sex. We didn't have many opportunities for meeting other gay people since all the bars were closed, since it was illegal to cruise, since if anybody found out on your job that you were gay, you'd be fired. You'd be pushed out of your apartment if your landlord knew you were gay. I mean, it was criminalized. And so when gay liberation came along, I think that the liberation part meant for people my age, sexual liberation. And then to have only 10 years later to have all that disappear and somebody blow a whistle, it was just intolerable, and that we hoped to play Russian roulette with our health. In my own case, I found out I was positive in 1985, but I was fortunately one out of every 100 people is what they call a slow progressor, which means, yes, you're infected, yes, you're T cell counts are going down, but so slowly that by the time mine were dangerously low, the new medications had come on stream.
But you couldn't have known that right away. You must have thought it was your death sentence.
I did. And I just pulled the covers over my head when I found out in 1985 that I was positive, and I thought, oh, I'll be dead in a year or two. And then eventually I realized, oh, my God, I guess I'll go on living. So I better do something.
Edmund White has done a lot. He's published novels, essays, and a whole bunch of gossipy, honest memoirs. The most recent is called Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris. If you like this conversation, subscribe to our podcast. That way you can listen to the show whenever and wherever you want. Just visit our website and click on the podcast link. It's at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. The show is produced by Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Steve Mullen at Walk West Music wrote our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.